Isaiah 8:1-9:7. The ninth talk in a series on the book of Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on November 29, 1998, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Chapters 8 and part of 9, I was hoping that we could get to a seasonally appropriate stopping place today, and I think we can make it. We'll go halfway into chapter 9 of Isaiah. This section that we've started in Isaiah, starting with chapter 7, is a lengthy one. It goes on for almost 30 chapters, in which Isaiah is just developing the themes that he introduced in the first five chapters of Isaiah, and he is just elaborating on and extending those themes. And so it's kind of all of a piece, but we're going to make a stop here in mid chapter 9. We have another incident here in Isaiah in which a child is named, and the child has the name of the child, and the child both have prophetic significance, that they are signs from God. Let's look at the first few verses of chapter 8, verses 1 through 4. Then the Lord said to me, "Take for yourself a large tablet and write on it in ordinary letters, 'Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey,' and I will take to myself faithful witnesses for testimony, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Yeberechiah." So I approached the prophetess, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. Then the Lord said to me, "Name him Maher Shalal Hashbaz. That's quite a handle. "For before the boy knows how to cry, 'My father' or 'My mother,' the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria." Okay, so Isaiah is told to take this large tablet, and he is supposed to write on it, the Hebrew says, with a pen of man. And usually that's understood to be in ordinary letters. Most commentators take it that way. Just in normal letters to write out this Maher Shalal Hashbaz, which means swift is the booty and speedy is the prey. So he's supposed to write this out on this big tablet, and there are supposed to be two witnesses to this. One is a priest, and are they both priests? One is a priest, and the other one is apparently just a prominent man in Jerusalem. So they are to be witnesses, I think, as we read on, it's witnesses not just to the writing of this, but also to the significance of this, of this statement. And we'll see what the significance of the statement is as we progress. So they're supposed to write this out on a large tablet, and that will be as a reminder then to them of this, of what God has said. Furthermore, Isaiah is going to have a child, his wife will give birth to a child, and that child is to be named with this phrase that was written out on the board. So again, we've got a child being named with a name that has significance to the future of Judah. And God says that before this boy reaches an age at which he can say, "My mother, my father," then Samaria and Syria will be overrun and plundered by the Assyrians. Apparently that's about at age 2, Hebrew's hard, so it may be a little bit longer, 2.5. It's about 2 years then, out in the future, that this is going to happen. So we're, remember last time we talked about Emmanuel being named. And the same thing was said with respect to Emmanuel, that when Emmanuel reaches a certain age, then the countries of Syria and Israel will be, what's the word that was used? Forsaken. So we're apparently talking about the same event, but it's closer now, because it was when Emmanuel reaches the time when he knows good and evil, when he reaches the age when he rejects what is evil and does what is good, chooses to do what is good. So it's at that time of discernment for Emmanuel. It's at the time of just being able to say mama and daddy for this next child. So we're getting closer. It's more imminent. And what will happen is Damascus and Samaria, those are the capitals. Damascus, the capital of Syria. Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. They will be overrun by the Assyrians and plundered. So the time is getting closer. The time is down to about 2 years. We're progressing through the chronology here quite rapidly. Now, in the next section, God gives the significance, or the reason why this is going to happen, a restatement. He said it before, but now he's going to restate it, starting with verse 5. And again the Lord spoke to me further, saying, inasmuch as these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah, and rejoice in Rezin and the son of Remaliah, now therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates, even the king of Assyria and all his glory. And it will rise up over its channels and go over all its banks. Then it will sweep on into Judah, and it will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck, and the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land. God is with us. My translation says, O Emmanuel, but it's, that means God is with us, and I think that's the better thing to put in here. Okay, so this is the reason why this is going to happen. Why is it going to happen? It's going to happen because these people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah. Shiloah is the spring that feeds Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem. It comes out apparently between, someplace between where Mount Moriah and Mount Zion. So just that little saddle. These people, who are these people? Well, in context, the people that have been talked about are the Syrians and the people of Israel. But in context, it seems to be mainly focusing not on Syria, but on the people of Israel. That is, the northern kingdom, descendants of Abraham who have rebelled against God as a nation. Not that Judah has been innocent in such regard. Isaiah has made it clear that Judah is not free of any rebelliousness towards God. They are also afflicted with that problem. But Isaiah has more wholesalely rejected God and rebelled against him. That is why this is happening, because they have rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah. Now, it's unclear to me exactly what he has in mind when he says rejected the waters of Shiloah. Is he talking about Israel's refusal to acknowledge the primacy of Judah and the leadership of Judah? More specifically, the Davidic line, because Israel does not accept the Davidic line as king of all of Israel? Or is it not accepting the Jerusalem-based religion and priests? I'm not sure which it is, and it may not be that you can sort it out. But let me remind you how Israel came into being after the death of Solomon. I'm talking about the northern kingdom Israel. How did Judah and Israel split? After the death of Solomon, his son, Jeroboam, became the king in his place. Solomon had been a a rather hard king, a rather demanding king. He had spent lavishly in the construction of palaces and fortresses and building up the military, etc., etc. In order to fund that, he had to raise taxes and corvée labor and that sort of thing, all of the things that we pay into the government. He had to do the same thing, balance his budget. And the way you balance a budget is you take more money in. And so he was rather demanding as a king. So when he died, Rehoboam came into power, and he told the people of Israel that he was going to continue the policies of his father. This was at the advice of his young counselors, counselors that he gathered around himself that were of a similar age. They said, do the same thing and continue to be a firm taskmaster like your father was. Having declared that, the other tribes, the 10 of the tribes of Israel, decided that they would follow another man, Jeroboam, who was not a descendant of David. So they split away and became a different country with a different king, no longer faithful to the Davidic line. And Jeroboam, in order to make his rule firm and secure, decided that he was going to have to set up other places of worship other than Jerusalem, because if they just went down to Jerusalem, he wouldn't be able to make that break and develop a different kingdom, which was separate both politically and culturally. So he set up shrines at the north end of the territory and at the south end of the territory with golden calves, where the people of Israel were supposed to go and worship, established a different priesthood. So essentially, the state established a different religion. So it's hard for me to sort out where here did they reject the gently flowing waters of Shiloh. Is it because they rejected the Davidic king's line? Is it because they rejected Judah's primacy? Or is it that they rejected the religion of Judah? And I don't know that it can be separated out, because in essence they have rejected all of those things. Okay, so they rejected those things. What did they accept? It says that they rejoice in Rezin and in the son of Remaliah. So Rezin is the king of Syria, and the son of Remaliah is Pekah, who is then the king of Israel. So they have rejoiced in, put their faith in, the king of Israel and the king of Syria, rather than in the king of Judah and the leadership of Judah and the God of Judah. So what will happen? The strong, abundant waters of the Euphrates. And that's in reference to Assyria. Assyria was on the banks of the Euphrates in the Mesopotamia region, and Assyria was going to come and, like a flood, overrun Israel and Syria. Now, this flooding of the Euphrates that's going to overrun Syria and Israel is not going to stop at the border, but rather it's going to come on even into Judah. It says, then it will sweep on into Judah, it will overflow and pass through, it will reach even to the neck, and the spread of its wings will fill the breadth of your land. So the Syria is going to not stop at Israel and Syria, but sweep in into Judah and extend over all of Judah, even up to its neck. Later on, about 30 years after this is being spoken, it did indeed happen that Assyria came down into Judah, conquered most of the land of Judah, laid siege to Jerusalem. but was unable to conquer Jerusalem. The king of Assyria at the time, there, an inscription has been found written by the king of Assyria, who was, I believe, Sennacherib. And it said, I held Judah like a bird in my hand. Well, that's true in a sense, but he did not capture Jerusalem. It's not clear exactly why he didn't capture Jerusalem, but the Assyrian army in mid-siege of Jerusalem just pulled up tent stakes and took off. It isn't clear whether they were afraid that the Egyptians were coming, or whether something was happening back home, or whether they were afflicted with disease. It's not clear, but they just left. So what is predicted here did in fact happen, but it was 30 years later that the flood waters of the Assyrians swept into Judah, as he had said. Then it ends with, the last statement is, my translation says, O Emmanuel. But Emmanuel means God with us. If it's the name Emmanuel, it seems strange that it would be here. I'm not sure why he would be referring to Emmanuel, and in the context, the only Emmanuel that we have run into is the child that was named Emmanuel a few years earlier, and we talked about this last week, as a timeline indicating when this would come to pass. But the name means God with us. And what makes more sense to me is that this should be understood as God with us. In other words, the flood will sweep into Judah, but it will stop short of complete destruction of Judah because God is with us. For God is with us. So the flooding will be extensive in Judah. Assyria will essentially overrun Judah, but it will escape complete destruction because God is with us. Okay, now he makes a more general statement to the peoples of the world. Verses, let's do 9 through 10. Be broken, O peoples, and be shattered, and give ear, all remote places of the earth. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand, for God is with us. This is a bit of a taunt to the peoples of the world. God is saying, it doesn't matter what you do, peoples of the world, enemies of my chosen. It doesn't matter how hard you try. It doesn't matter how many alliances you try to build and how big the alliances. It doesn't matter how much you plan. It doesn't matter how much you arm up. My chosen people will be protected. The land of Judah will be saved. And the reason that will happen is because God is with us. God is with the people of Judah. Now, this is an interesting taunt on his part, because the situation that Judah is facing is this alliance of the Syrians and the Israelites, and their fear that they are going to come and conquer them. And they're afraid of this alliance of two nations. And God has assured Judah that they will not conquer Judah, but God is going to protect them and make sure that that does not happen. And here God is reassuring, he's saying again, it will not happen, it will not come to pass. In fact, they will be wiped out by the Assyrians. But he goes on to say, the peoples of the world cannot build an alliance big enough. They cannot amass enough weapons to bring down my people because I am with them. Okay, verses 11 through 15. For thus the Lord spoke to me with mighty power and instructed me not to walk in the way of his people, saying, you are not to say it is a conspiracy in regard to all that this people call a conspiracy, and you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. It is the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy, and he shall be your fear, and he shall be your dread. Then he shall become a sanctuary. But to both the houses of Israel, a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over, and a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and many will stumble over them. Then they will fall and be broken, and they will even be snared and caught. So the people of Judah are looking at the situation as it exists at this time, and they're saying, it's a conspiracy. They're after us. As if a conspiracy, an alliance, would be unconquerable, that they wouldn't be able to overcome it. In other words, they're saying in fear and dread, they're ganging up on us. But God's response is, you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. It is the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy. And he shall be your fear, and he shall be your dread. That if any fearing should be going on, it should be fear of God. God is the one ultimately to be respected. No number of men should ever be respected in the way that God should be respected. Fear God, not man. And God is going to become a sanctuary. God will be the provision, and will be with their escape, their salvation. But he goes on to say that although ultimately God is the sanctuary and salvation for Judah, he is going to be, to both the people of Israel and the people of Judah, he is going to be a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over. A rock to stumble, yes, over. And a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. God is going to be the kind of God that is hard for the people of Judah and Israel to accept as their God. There is something about the way that God operates that is going to grate on the people of Judah and Israel such that they stumble on him. That is, they just can't accept him as the God that he claims he is. Verse 16 through the end. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will even look eagerly for him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. And when they say to you, consult the mediums and the spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, it is because they have no dawn. And they will pass through the land hard-pressed and famished. And it will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged and curse their king and their God as they face upward. Then they will look to the earth and behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be driven away into darkness. So Isaiah is instructed now apparently to bind up the testimony. That is, apparently, put all this stuff together. I don't know whether it means the table on which this phrase was written, plus these words that I've just read. In any case, he's supposed to put this aside, seal this. This is going to be Exhibit A at a future point in time when all of this comes to pass. And I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. That Isaiah is saying, this stuff is all going to be bound up and sealed. This is among my disciples, seal the law among my disciples. So it's all going to be entrusted to people who will faithfully guard it for the day when it's needed. And I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. Now, what is he waiting for? He's waiting for God to fulfill his promises. Which promises? It's not entirely clear, but he says, who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. It could be just the promises that he's talked about with respect to Syria and Israel, and those countries being overrun by the Assyrians. But it could be more extensive, that is, waiting for God to fulfill his promises with respect to Judah and this blindness that has come over Judah. Because he says, who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob? I will even look eagerly for him. So Isaiah's perspective is, I am just going to sit and wait eagerly for God to bring about the things that he has promised to do. I don't know when, I don't know exactly how, but I know it will come to pass because God is the God that I know him to be. So I will wait eagerly. And Isaiah sees himself and his children as signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts. So Isaiah, through what he has proclaimed, and his children, for what they symbolize, have become signs. We talked about it last week. It's not miraculous signs, but they're more reminders of what God has claimed, so that the people who are responsive to God will hold to those promises that God has made until they come to pass. Then he says, now, when all this stuff gets troubling, when all this stuff doesn't seem to be happening the way God has said it will happen, when times get really hard and people get desperate, they lose hold on these promises. And inevitably, it is going to happen that they are going to consult mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter. Now, I was trying to think, what is the driving force? Why do people go to spiritists and mediums? Now, I've said before, and I still think it's the case, that the people of Judah have not abandoned God completely. That is, they haven't ceased to at least say and pretend that they worship Yahweh, the God of Abraham. And I think that that holds true, that they don't dispense with God completely, but in their minds they are making adjustments to reality. That is, they are trying to find ways to assure their future and their security going beyond what God has told them to do, and in fact in violation of what God has told them to do. So again, when they resort to mediums and spiritists, I don't think it's they're saying, we're going to, at least in their minds, they're not saying we're turning our backs on Yahweh. But I suspect it's just a matter of absolute desperation. They're being besieged. Judah is hanging on by its fingernails to existence. So the pressure is really on. They're very desperate. And I think they're desperate for information, more specific information about exactly what is going to happen so that they can take the appropriate steps. Just in thinking a little 2K problem, I think we can identify with it. We would like to know exactly what it's going to look like in, 14 months from now or whatever it is. Because if we knew exactly what was going to happen, we'd be ready. We'd prepare for it. We'd take the proper measures. In absence of that information, it's very difficult to know what to do. So I think what happens is, in times of desperation, in times of dire need, we want to take more into our hands. And in order to take more into our hands, we need to know more than we know. So I suspect that's the driving force behind their consulting mediums and spiritists. They want to be able to manage more of their lives, just to prevent disaster from coming upon them. But Isaiah's response is, no, not mediums and spiritists, but rather to the law and to the testimony. Where do we go? We go to the law and to the testimony. And I think what he means is, he's talked about in verse 16, binding up the testimony, sealing the law among my disciples. I think what he's saying is, look again at the principles that God has established by which we as human beings ought to live. Remind yourselves of those principles. What is right? What is wrong? Who is God? Who are we? And what is our relationship to Him? Firm those up. That's what's critical. If you're going to prepare for disaster, that's the way to prepare for disaster. So to the law and to the testimony, that is the promises. The promises aren't very specific, but they are promises nevertheless. And it's something that they can hold on to. It is certain, it is sure, these things will happen. Isaiah is saying that's the response, that's the thing that makes sense, not to the spiritists, not to the mediums, but to the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, if people don't respond this way to the law and to the testimony, if that's not their response, then it is because they have no dawn. There's no light. And they will pass through the land hard-pressed and famished. And it will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged and curse their king and their God as they face upward. So they're going to look up at God and they're going to say, curse you because you have done this. Curse you because I am hungry and famished. Rather than having reminded themselves of the principles on which life as human beings is based, ought to be based. And it says, they and curse their king and their God as they face upward. I think that means their king and God, that is the same thing. God the king. But I'm not sure. It could be the authority that God has placed in their midst as well as God. I'm not sure. Then they will look to the earth. Then they'll look at circumstances. And behold, distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be driven away into darkness. So they'll curse God, then they'll look at their circumstances, and they'll see nothing but despair, nothing but distress and anguish. And it'll overwhelm them, and they will be driven away into darkness. I think what that means is further rebelliousness and rejection of God. Now, there's a provision for this. God is going to dispel that darkness. In this next section, in the first part of chapter 9, Isaiah explains how God is going to deal with this darkness that Isaiah has predicted will come over the land of Judah. Verse 1, but there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt, but later on he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. Thou shalt multiply the nation. Thou shalt increase their gladness. They will be glad in thy presence, as with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For thou shalt break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and cloak rolled in blood will be for burning, fuel for the fire. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. On the throne of David and over his king, to establish it and to behold it and uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. So how is God going to deal with this darkness that he says will come over the land of Judah? He is going to dispel that darkness. And the darkness will be first dispelled. The first glimmer of light will be in a land that he treated with contempt, in the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, on the other side of the Jordan. That's the area that when the Assyrians come in, that's the first place that they conquer, and they conquer that in the first wave. They take Syria, and they take that part of Israel first. They come back 3 years later to conquer the rest of Israel. So I think that's what he means when he says that in earlier times he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt, because that was the first area to be conquered by the Assyrians. But that's where the light will first, the first glimmer of light will occur. And as is pointed out in, I believe it's Matthew, this passage is cited. And that's where Jesus began his ministry. Jesus first began preaching in this land on the other side of the Jordan. And what will happen? The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. So apparently what's being described here is Jesus is coming and preaching the nature of the gospel, the truth of the gospel. And as is described here, then, those who live in the dark land, the light will shine on them. So the gospel is going to dispel them, this darkness that's been covering the land, and will bring clarity and truth into an atmosphere of confusion and rebellion. The nation is going to be restored then. The nation shall multiply. He will increase their gladness. And people will rejoice as they rejoice when they divide the spoil. So this light that comes in is going to completely transform this area that's been covered with darkness. They will overthrow all of their oppressors and no longer be subject to that kind of oppression, defeat their enemies. And in fact, in the defeating of their enemies, apparently it will be, the defeat will be so total that the boots and the cloaks of the enemy soldiers will be fuel for the fire, will be for burning. And how is this going to come about? 6 and 7 explain that a child will be born to us. So this is predictive then of Jesus as king. He will be born to the Jews. Government will rest on his shoulders. So a king will come who will have the government in his control. He will have these names: Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. All of these apparently things that can be attributed to this king. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. So it's an eternal government that will be characterized constantly by peace. On the throne of David, so this is in the line of David, and justice and righteousness will be established from then on and forevermore. So an eternal, then, kingdom is what will result from this with Jesus on the throne, this son that was to be born to the people of Israel. And this is God's way of rolling back the darkness that Isaiah was predicting would come over the people of Israel. Rolling them back of the darkness, a perfect kingdom being established, one in which justice and righteousness reign, and one that is eternal. And it will come to pass, because the zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. I was thinking about this last night. It really is going, it puts Christmas in a different light for me. I guess I've always thought of Jesus as coming to save the world. And in a sense, that's true. But there's another sense in which Jesus came for a specific purpose, and that was he came to bring light into the darkness that descended upon Israel and Judah. That was his specific purpose. We have played into that. We are very fortunate that we have been brought in through kind of the back door, and that grace has been given to us in a special way. This just occurred to me, I should have looked it up, but the story of the Gentile woman who is satisfied with the crumbs that fall off of the table. We're in that position, that we're getting the crumbs that fall off of the table. We're in a very fortunate situation. We benefit from Jesus' coming and his death on the cross and the provision that was made for our sins. But really, his number one mission was to redeem his people, to come and shed light on his people and redeem them. God has been very gracious to us. It's unfortunate that our Thanksgiving holiday is one in which originally thanks was given to God by people who survived very difficult times and credited God for the fact that they were able to persevere, that they were able to establish a new society in this new world, one that was not entirely hospitable. I remember reading, they actually intended to go to, I think it was Virginia, but they got off course and ended up in Massachusetts. They would have been better off in Virginia in some ways. But in other ways, in God's providence, they ended up in the better place. And I think that they realized that. That those hardships that they endured were in the long run very good for them. And they probably, the harder circumstances in Maryland, in Massachusetts, were probably in the long run beneficial for them. But that holiday that's set aside for our nation to give thanks to God for his provision for us has been co-opted by the culture. And so I noticed particularly this year that no longer do we say we're giving thanks to God for what he's done. Now we are just thankful, without any expressed thing to which we are thankful. Being or whatever, that's just left empty. So we just have this feeling of contentment or whatever, rather than actually being thankful to someone, giving thanks to someone. That's a very unfortunate thing, because we are incredibly blessed. We are blessed as a nation, and we are blessed as Christians that God has made provision for us and has forgiven us of our sins and provided us with salvation and allowed us to come in as adopted children into this kingdom that he is setting up, that he is taking the people of the descendants of Abraham, and he is going to bring about, transform them into a people that are heart and soul devoted to God. And we are coming in as adopted children into that. And we are therefore very fortunate, and I think ought to be truly thankful for what he's done. Questions, comments? Don will take that.
In chapter 8, verse 15, Isaiah says, "Behold, I and children whom the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel, the Lord of hosts." The plural there made me wonder if Emmanuel could not also have been Isaiah's child as well as Maharshal Ashras. Did that ever...
There are commentators that have suggested that, and I suppose that that is possible. But we do have another account for the plural, because he has another child. If you look back at chapter 7, verse 3, "Then the Lord said to Isaiah, 'Go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shir-Yashub.'" And that name means a remnant shall, something about a remnant shall return. So he has at least two children that we know of, apart from Emmanuel, that have names that are, that encapsulate a theme, a major theme of Isaiah's ministry. So that could account for the plural in and of itself. Now, whether Emmanuel was a child of Isaiah or not, I don't really know. There was another question, Craig.
Yeah, on the first one where it's chapter 9. Chapter 9, verse 1, where it says the land of Naphtali, and then the Galilee of the Gentiles. Yeah. Is it speaking of Galilee in the New Testament, says where it's west of the Sea of Galilee, or are we talking east here, east of the Jordan?
East.
And how would the, how would the Jewish Pharisees and scribes in the New Testament time view this in its fulfillment? Could they have that misconstrued when Christ was coming as a fulfillment in a physical sense? Or it doesn't seem like geographically it could be. How is this worked out in the end times, as far as we're concerned, with Christ coming and establishing a kingdom there? I'm trying to see how it's played out geographically and how it would have been understood way back when and how it's to be understood now for the future.
I don't know. I don't know how Jews today view this verse, how they interpret it. I just don't know. I don't know how the Pharisees at the time of Jesus interpreted this verse. But this is cited in Matthew. Maybe we should look at that. Let me see if I can find that. Matthew 4:15. Let's start at Matthew 4:12. "Now when he heard that John had been taken into custody, he withdrew into Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he came and settled in Capernaum, which is by the sea, in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. This was to fulfill what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet, saying, 'The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who were sitting in darkness saw a great light, and to those who were sitting in the land and shadow of death, upon them a light dawned. From that time Jesus began to preach and say, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." So as Matthew is looking back at Isaiah, he sees that as predictive of the fact that Jesus was going to begin his public ministry in that particular geographical location, on the other side of the Jordan, on the other side of it would be the east side of the Sea of Galilee. So that's...
Sorry, but I'm looking at the map. It's on the northwest. It's on the northwest part of the Sea of Galilee. But it is northeast of Nazareth.
It's not east, but it's from the standpoint of Jerusalem. As the crow flies, you have to go past the Jordan. Past
the source of the Jordan.
That could be... I don't recall. Yeah, I don't. What is your question, Craig? Is that?
I don't know.
Okay. That makes it easier to answer.
No, I'll talk to it.
Okay. Okay.
The key David is that it says somebody went up to Capernaum in the land of Naphtali and Zebulun.
Okay. Okay, any other questions?
What's your understanding of the fact that he said that before the child knows how to say, "My father, my mother," about 2 years, and then actually ended up being 30 years?
Well,
who were they talking about? The same thing?
No, those are talking about two separate things.
What happened within the 2 years?
Within the 2 years, Assyria attacked Israel in Syria. I keep calling it Syria. Oftentimes it's referred to here as Aram. Assyria attacked Israel, that is the northern kingdom,
okay,
and Aram, about 2 years after this. What happened later was Assyria attacked Judah as well. And that's about 30 years later.
Yes.
Assyria attacked on three different occasions, attacked Palestine. The first one was the one that's referred to here, 2 years after Maher Shaul Hashbaz was born. At that time, they conquered all of Syria and took part of Israel. They came back about 2 years later and took the rest of Israel. Then they came back about 28 years after that and overran all of Judah except for Jerusalem.
Okay.
So three different times that Assyria attacked.
Okay. I got to the end. One more thing about his name. Do you have any more to say about, who is the booty and who is the prey? And
so what's that expression supposed to mean?
Oh yeah, when were they fast?
The best sense I can make of it is what's being said is it won't be long until the booty and the prey are taken away. They are.
I don't think so. I think what it means is they are
quick to go. They are. Their departure is imminent. I think that's what he's... I mean, that's the thing that makes the most sense in here, is that the time is close to when they will be nothing but booty and prey.
In chapter 8, in verses 14 and 15, was the section where they were saying, Isaiah was saying that God would be a stone that causes men to stumble. And he says that there was something about God that was going to make men stumble. And then he didn't say anything more. And then I presume, I'm just making sure I understand this, that I presume the thing about God that made them stumble was the distress that he was going to cause them and the difficulties of Assyria coming through. Is that what you're meaning to say by that, or is there something else that was causing them to stumble?
Well, I'm not sure that we know specifically why it is that the people of Israel, I don't know if we can know exactly, why the people of Judah and Israel have been so hard of heart in response to God. But if we just look at it humanly speaking, I think part of it is the suffering that Israel has been subjected to and making sense of that. I think that just humanly speaking, that seems to be a part of it. But otherwise, I don't know that we can know specifically why they have been so unresponsive to God.
Well, one thing I was toying around with, and maybe this is the same thing what you said, but I know that when people have been teaching in the New Testament, there's this sense that when really hard times come, it sort of separates whether people really are truly trusting the Lord or not. And I'm wondering.